You look like a Velázquez character.
A what character?
Velázquez, a Spanish painter.
Uh-huh.
Oh. Often painted members of the court of King Philip, whatever is the fifth of Spain. And they were often men like you with a mop of hair like that and a goatee.
So it's Elizabethan era, yeah. Okay.
I'm not never very good at dates, at putting dates to things. Anyway. Mm.
You mean in terms of like stuff you've done or like
yeah, of anything. I mean, I think Doctor Who was very special to me because it goes right back to my childhood. And Doctor Who I just remember as a strange thing. The worst thing about Doctor Who is everybody's got an opinion. And some of the things they come up with are just... In Suicide Squad, Margot Robbie was there in some terrible Harlequin scanty kind of thing. There was a rain machine. She stood in the rain all day long for like 3 days and never complained. I thought, that's the real thing. The actor that I am now probably comes from there. Are you deliberately stamping on my c***? Because if you are, I'll take that f***ing repulsive unicorn vomit tie. I'll use it to floss your alimentary canal. Do I make myself perfectly f***ing clear?
Hey everyone, I'm Billy and welcome back to Half the Picture. I'm so unbelievably thrilled to say that our special guest this episode is none other than Peter Capaldi. So I've been a fan of Peter's for years. I mean, going back to his stuff in, you know, programs like Doctor Who, of course, where he played the 12th Doctor, you know, seminal for me, and also his work on, you know, The Thick of It as Malcolm Tucker, as well as his musical career, sharing a stage with Franz Ferdinand at Glastonbury over the summer. Films like Local Hero and The Suicide Squad, as well with like Margot Robbie and James Gunn. I love his screen presence, the command he has of the screen and the frame, his versatility as an actor, you know, the sensitivity he has, how he can go from being warm and gentle as the Doctor to something like, you know, sweary Malcolm Tucker, you know, and be this bullish figure. Speaking of which, there will be a fair bit of swearing in this episode, just to warn some sensitive members of the viewership. So without further ado, let's roll on my conversation with Peter Capaldi. Enjoy.
Hi Peter, welcome to Half the Picture.
Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. We're, you know, we're enormous fans, as you probably gathered from some of the chat you've been, all the handshakes you had before we rolled.
Well, that's kind of you. That's very generous.
Mm. So looking back at this year for you, 2025, I think it's fair to say it's been a pretty, you know, it's been, at least in my perspective, it seems like it's been a pretty amazing year for you. I mean, just to rattle off some of the things that you've had going on, you've headlined an episode of Black Mirror. You know, working with Charlie Brooker, who's an amazing writer, Black Mirror, incredible series. You've got series 3 of Devil's Hour coming down the pipe, you know, sort of in the next few months, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
You had your new album out, Sweet Illusions, which is amazing, which I love, out in the spring. And in the summer, you took to the stage with Franz Ferdinand as part of Glastonbury.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what's all that been like?
Well, it's been great. I've also shot season 2 of Criminal Record, which is a show we do for Apple, which we're just finishing editing at the moment. So that's taken up actually most of the year. So all these other things that went on were lovely, but they're sort of, were sidebars to that. Great. I mean, the Glastonbury thing was amazing. I mean, I just sort of came out. I'm a fan of Franz Ferdinand, but I don't know them. Mm. Although they all went to art school in Glasgow, to the same art school I went to. So I felt as if they were kind of from a similar background, just a different generation. But how that occurred was I have put together a band to try to play my music live. Mm. So my friend Christine Dinwiddie, who works in music, said, "Oh, you've got to do this." And I said, "Well, I don't know how to do it." And she said, "Well, I'll find some people for you so you can have it." Some musicians, and she found me this great group of musicians. But Charlotte, who plays the bass in my band, her partner is Audrey, who plays the drums in Franz Ferdinand. And I had been rehearsing with my band, and I had said to them, this song, whatever it was, I said, this has to be like a Franz Ferdinand song. You know, it has to be like a heat-seeking missile. It has to be really, really tight, and all the little riffs have to be worked out, and we have to be able to do it exactly, precisely the same every time we do it. And I think she'd said that, reported that to Audrey, and I think Audrey had reported that to the band, which was always obviously a confirmation that I was a fan. And then they just got in touch, and Alex said, would I like to play with them at Glastonbury? Which was like a total, what? Where did that come from? And then I wasn't sure what they wanted me to do. And I thought they were going to do some strange Doctor Who sort of thing, have a TARDIS or something like that. I thought, I don't really want to do all that.
Have you come out of a TARDIS on stage?
All of that, carry on. He said, no, he said, I want you to sing a song with us. I said, well, what song? And he said, take me out. I said, what, like your biggest hit? He said, yeah. Okay. I'm in. So, but that was months and months beforehand. Mm. And we didn't know that Lewis Capaldi was going to be playing on the same day. That came later. So that was very funny. But I just walked around for months singing this, you know, with my headphones and singing this song. And in fact, one of the bands said, they have a friend who lives in North London who said they'd seen me walking around singing, take me out. Because I was terrified that I would get it wrong. Mm. But it was just joyful. I mean, it was just that you can't lose, really. I mean, they're fantastic. It's a sunny day. The crowd's having a good time. Even if you mess it up, who cares? You know, so I just had a laugh. The only thing was I hadn't been through. A, they didn't tell me. I thought it was going to be in a tent or something. I didn't know that that stage was so big.
Mm. Yeah, it's one of the main stages.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I thought, because I just thought, well, there's the pyramid. Because I hadn't been to Glastonbury. I thought that's the pyramid stage and then tents. So I thought we would just be in a tent. So when I got there and I heard the crowd, I don't go to football matches, so I'm not around football. So I heard the sound move through my body, and it was like the Colosseum or something. It was this sound. Then they didn't tell me it was going to be televised either. So all this was news on the day. But it was a laugh. I'm very grateful to them because it was just fun. It was just joyful, and it was, you know, you can't lose. You know, they're brilliant. Mm. Even if I'd really messed it up, they'd still have just in the crowd. It's just a wonderful experience.
Yeah. No, it was to watch as well. I mean, as a fan, and obviously, you know, it was completely unannounced. Like, no one had any idea. Yeah. And when I remember when it came up on my phone, and like, and when you came out on stage, and it was just like, and all of what you just said, obviously, it sounded like you really wanted to, for it to go well and to get it right.
Yeah.
But when you came on stage, it was just the coolest thing ever, you know, to me. And it was just like, you just seemed to had, you, it looked like you, to me, you had it totally down. Like, you know, you were just, and it looked like you were enjoying yourself. All those thousands of people just out there, and you were just, you know, playing to them and like singing, you know, it was incredible to see.
Thank you. Well, the funny thing was, I remember the, I met the band the day before. Because they had a rehearsal place in Wembley, and they said, "Could you want to come in? Because we're rehearsing." The whole thing about festivals is new to me, but bands bring their own sets. So they had in Wembley, they had their own set, which was there to kind of, to me, it was a vaguely kind of light entertainment, two Ronnies kind of that little staircase to walk down, and they had a shiny floor as well, which they had laid on the stage at Glastonbury, but it was blinding. So there was a mad panic before they come, because you only have 20 minutes between bands to change the gear and the set. Mm. So there was a mad panic while they lifted this tinfoil off the floor. But I knew I had to be careful going down these steps, because that was, the tinfoil was left on the steps, and it was really, really glaring. So I thought, just be very careful. So I might have looked cool, but I was just being careful.
Is that partly why you had your shades on, the iconic shades? Because you weren't just like hit in the eye by all this... It's light.
No, I thought, well, if you can't wear shades now, when can you wear them? So I said, wear them.
Yeah, well, they weren't the Sonic glasses, though. Not the Sonic glasses, not those particular shades. Oh, it was incredible to see. And, obviously, and you know, the crowd clearly absolutely loved it. I mean, like, you know, just like all the, you know, like I say, I can't imagine what it would have been like. You see that you said that reverb goes through your bones, and you just feel that. I imagine the adrenaline, like, coming off of that stage afterwards. I imagine you would trembling with the adrenaline.
I was, but I just went home. Yeah. You know, it was great. We sort of did it very well, I think. We just arrived 2 hours before the gig. We did our song and then we left. Got a bit of the, you know, got a veggie burger and whatever, and hung around for a little while and saw some stars and stuff. But I was glad just to go and do that and not be locked into a whole sybaritic weekend of carry on.
Yeah. You mentioned there when you were talking about Franz Ferdinand and how they come out of that Glaswegian sort of art rock background.
Yeah.
I mean, as someone who's a fan of yours and who is, you know, aware of you and your work going right back to, you know, like the stuff you did obviously back in the 80s and going before that back in the 70s when you were coming out of the same environment of working class Glasgow in that time, that sort of punk era. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated to ask you about that, because it seems to me like we've had guests on this podcast before who've come from a similar milieu, like the writer Grant Morrison, who's a great Glaswegian writer of prose and comics.
Yeah.
But they talk about how it was quite a tough upbringing, that sort of time and place, but it totally informs who they are in a really sort of rich way. And yeah, I was just curious to ask, like, how do you think growing up in that very fertile creative environment of sort of west of Scotland in the 70s and 80s informed who you are and like and what you do?
I think completely. But it was also, it's not just a case of being the west of Scotland, it's a case of where it is in time as well. And people today don't realise how difficult it was to access. If you were interested in Georges Méliès, the silent filmmaker, you couldn't go on YouTube and look up Georges Méliès and find 12 documentaries about him and lots of clips of his films and stuff like that. You would have to go to a library and find a book, and then you'd have to wait until there was perhaps a retrospective or something of his films that maybe came to the Glasgow Film Theatre, whatever. So you did not have access to stuff. The means, the route to gaining access was a longer, harder one. And in that journey, you probably stumbled across a lot of things that you might not have been setting out to have a look at, but you ended up having a look at them. And they... you were interested in them. If you wanted to do anything, if you wanted to be in a band, which I was in a band, you had to be, and you weren't signed to any label or anything. The ethos of the time, I'm talking about like 1976, I went to art school then, and that's when punk sort of exploded. And with that came a sense that you were capable of having a go. You should have a go. It was your duty to have a go, and this is what everyone did. But that meant you had to be in a band, you had to try and write songs, you had to make posters, you had to put posters up, you had to record demos and little cassettes, you had to go and find venues that could be where you could play gigs, you had to go and meet the bar owners who ran those places. It was a kind of full-time job while being an art student. So I don't know whether, I mean, Glasgow has a kind of sort of, it's quite a tough city. Of course it is, because there's a lot of poverty in it. I don't think I came from my family weren't particularly tough, but they came from, you know, I was brought up in a tenement and all that kind of carry on. But then we moved out to the suburbs, as people do. There's an attitude of preciousness about creativity. Because it's a little harder to come by, or it's not around you so much. It's not in the culture so much. So those people who were creative, and it's a hugely creative town. I think a lot of industrial towns are like this. They kind of revere and nourish their own creatives because it's a sort of privilege and it's a sort of... it has a rebelliousness in it against the, if everything's about work, if everything's about survival, to be creative is to be different from that. And it's also what people deserve. But I think it was different times as well. I think there was an excitement about having this full range of creativity possibly open to you. But it's a strange city. I mean, it has a kind of, I always think it's got a kind of sort of slightly noirish quality because it has these old Victorian kind of buildings, and then it has these rather brutal Soviet style kind of council estates, and there's a lot of horribleness and there's a lot of romanticism. So these are fertile grounds.
Well, that kind of sense of sort of brutalism, that quite urban sense of brutalism that you describe, and also that kind of romanticism, that kind of a slight sort of street magic quality. As I say, as a fan, it's something that I see in your work, that I feel in your work quite a lot. You're going to like Sweet Illusions, your album, the lyrics on that album, you're talking about urban interpersonal situations between the characters in those songs, but also there's a fantastical kind of almost slightly cosmic edge. And I was curious actually to ask about that, because how much of that sort of sense of kind of the urban reality but also the cosmic kind of sheen to that, like looking at, like sort of looking out from that at the stars, if you like, how much do you think that was sort of born from the wellspring of your lifelong love of Doctor Who? Because, as you know, I think is quite well known, you've been a fan of Doctor Who since you were a child.
I think it was possibly the other way around.
Oh.
You know, in the sense that I already had this imagination that was looking into these areas. And that came along and it fitted. But it was only one aspect of my imagination. Mm. I mean, I think Doctor Who was and is very special to me, as the people who Mark Gatiss said to me, oh, it runs very deep with you. which is true, because it goes right back to my childhood. Mm. You got to remember, I was, you know, in the 60s, the space race is beginning, you know, and the Beatles are blossoming. And the whole world is kind of changing. And because I'm older and I can read history books, I can see that there's a historical context to this. There's a post-war effort to rebuild the world in a better way. This is gone now, you know. But there was an ethos that went through the whole culture of trying to make a better place for everyone. And so all of this art began to happen, and these changes in culture. And Doctor Who, I just remember as a strange thing, as a strange kind of quite spooky and but quite magical thing. So, yeah, I was very, very taken with it. But I also think it became sort of, when I became Doctor Who, it sort of becomes... your personal relationship with it becomes irrelevant, because you're the sort of the face of a brand, which is not my relationship with it.
No.
But that's what you become. So it becomes slightly trickier and more trying to protect your own relationship with it while also selling it and also keeping everybody in work down in Cardiff and having the responsibilities to keep the show it's slightly different.
Yeah. So you say that being the figurehead of that show, it's huge, and it's, you know, obviously it's huge. It's a phenomenon, that show. People in this country and now, you know, people around the world love that show. I mean, you've taken that show along with like Stephen Moffat, you know, that showrunner, and Jenna, and you know, Paul Mackey. You've taken that show around the world. You've toured it practically when you were the Doctor. Obviously, being such a fan from such an early age, and then as you say now, being the figurehead of that brand, it sounds like it must complicate the relationship you have with it somewhat. You have to kind of protect your own personal love for it, I guess, in some ways. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I'm saying that I, you know, my relationship with it is a personal one.
Mm.
It's what I loved when I was a kid. I didn't sit when I was a kid going, oh, it'd be great to take this around the world and sell it in territories and get Radio Times covers and make a lot of money. And the show became very, very big.
Mm.
And it was never like that when I loved it. So it was became a different thing. I think the responsibilities of playing the part became there were more of them. There were more things that you had to do rather than just... I mean, I think in the old days, you know, if you were John Pertwee or Tom Baker or something like that, you'd probably... you know, you spend most of your year making it and then a bit of your year promoting it. But it wasn't this in-your-face kind of thing that was suddenly was really important to... the BBC, or suddenly really important to a brand that had to be maintained.
Yeah.
It was just a show that some kids really loved and other kids didn't care about and wanted to watch football and, you know, or you grew out of, or, you know.
Mm.
It became this sort of very, very important thing.
Mm.
I think less in a cultural way and more in a economic way.
Yeah. And I guess going into that then, when you were first sort of took on the role, I mean, did you... in that sense, with everything you just said, did you know what you were getting into? I mean, obviously, Matt and David and Chris had shouldered that responsibility in the years running up to you coming on. Did they sort of prep you at all? Or was there? Did you know what you were getting into in that regard?
Well, Matt and David were lovely because I knew, and they were. And I spoke to them about it, and they were great.
Hmm.
David said to me, "You know, you will just be much more visible." And I didn't really quite know what he meant, but. I soon learned that it just meant you were suddenly, people just recognised you all the time, which was quite nice, actually. I mean, it was a little scary. It was scary because I knew that life would change in some way. And it's a genie. Once that's out of the bottle, you can't put it back, you know. So if you lose your privacy to that degree, it's quite an extreme kind of feeling. It makes you feel quite vulnerable. But I was lucky that I was older, that I wasn't a young actor who was, you know, still had a huge career that they wanted to pursue or was going to clubs or pubs or anything like that. I was quite, you know, and remain quite a dull person in that respect. So there was nothing really. I used to have press sitting outside my house and paparazzi and all that. But there was nothing for them to see other than me going to Marks and Spencer's to get the macaroni and cheese for the tea. So they got fed up with that. But it is very exposing. It is very, it makes you feel quite vulnerable. But it's also delightful. It's absolutely wonderful to have people look on you as Doctor Who and smile at you and be cheered up by your simply by your presence. And you don't want to disappoint people. You know, that becomes a little bit of a strain because you don't want people to be, I think Matt said that to me, you don't want them to be the one that the kid goes, oh, he was horrible. I love Doctor Who, but he was horrible, which Matt would never, ever be. You've always got that in the back of your head that you're, you know, if you're not very pleasant, then that will be toxic material. That will it'll be nuclear.
Well, I think this whole conversation about, you know, the responsibilities of the role, not just as an actor, but as, yeah, as you say, as the figurehead of a brand, I think it's been kind of quite in the conversation at the moment, what with the sort of where Doctor Who is now, it is a lot of responsibility. And I think, like, it's not for everyone. It's, you know, and I mean, Richard Osman was talking about it on his podcast and how maybe they were wondering whether Shuti Gatwa, who's brilliant, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Shuti Gatwa's Doctor, but there was a conversation that maybe, you know, he wasn't cognizant perhaps when he took on the role of all of that. And maybe it was a lot. And yeah, I guess what are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you feel like it's good to be prepped? You need to know?
I don't think they can prep you really for it because it's also about being famous. If you're not famous, then you're suddenly famous. I mean, I was well known, but not famous to that degree. That's a whole different ballgame. It changes things. Shuti's great. I think it's wonderful. And it's a tough job and whatever, you know, you do whatever you feel is right. I think he's a brilliant doctor. I don't know. I think the show is, sometimes I think it's a little bit of a victim of its success. You know, the show that I loved was tinier, was a tiny thing, a little small thing that survived. It just survived, and then it didn't. But nobody knew that it was worming its way into the culture in such a deep way. And I think that's what I have an affinity with. Is, well, Matt used to talk about it. He used to say, because you go, you film, and you get like half an hour for lunch, and you go, oh, shall I eat lunch, or shall I try and sleep? But you go to a trailer, and then there's... And there's somebody there who says, you know, an MP's just arrived with his children. Can he to visit the TARDIS? Would you like to show them around? Well, you've got to go and show them around. Here's some new Doctor Who figures. Would you like to approve these? Okay, I'm going to do that. You know, so, and this goes in. And there's a costume for next year. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. And then when you finish filming, there's a... You're sort of given a schedule for what promotional duties, and you go, oh, yes, it's great kind of going around the world, but you go, we talk to all of these people and them all morning? Yeah. So, you know, it's tough, but it's great. You know, I'm not complaining about it because it was blissful as well to be the center of attention for so long. You know, I liked it. I think there's a, You'd run out of energy eventually. I think it would crush you in terms of, because you also have to do, to me, the most important thing was doing the show. And that was a lot of work. It was wonderful work, but you had to learn all those lines and you literally could not, there wasn't enough time to learn all the lines. So your most basic thing as an actor, which is, you know, you learn your lines, and you turn up and you deliver them, you couldn't do. Because by Thursday, You know, I had lots of rewrites. By Thursday, by Friday, I no longer had a grasp of the line. So I had to apologize to people in the morning and say, look, I don't really, can we stick them up? Can I stick my lines on the TARDIS scanner? But then I discovered that that was a long-standing tradition among doctors, going back to the beginning of having bits of your script stuck. Stuck on the TARDIS. But it's not, I don't like that. Mm. You know, I don't like that. I'd rather have a grasp of the whole thing.
Sure. And was it just because the scripts were coming in quite thick and fast, or were they being rewritten? Or
it's just that they're substantial. Mm. The Doctor's a huge part and has a lot of big speeches. And you have to find a way to do those speeches that is different. You can't just stand there and present this information. Mm. Because essentially that's what you're doing, is presenting this information to get the plot moving. But you can't do that. You have to find a way to illuminate them, or to make them more interesting, or make them... You have to be an entertainer. You've got to come up with ideas and figure that out and practice it. So it takes a while.
So it takes a while. Yeah. I mean, speaking of, I guess, long speeches and dialogue and scripts, and also kind of talking about what you mentioned, what you said about Doctor Who being a brand. So at the time of recording this, next week will be the 10th anniversary of the episode Heaven Sent of mm-hmm. Series 9, which has kind of, over the last 10 years, has kind of become the one of the most, if not the most, beloved episode of Doctor Who by many of the fans. I mean, I think only a couple of years ago it was voted by the fans as their favourite episode of the whole show, going back to the 60s. Mm-hmm. And that's an episode, just to give anyone who hasn't seen it an idea, that episode is your Doctor is trapped in a kind of literal and figurative castle of grief on his own, with no companion, nobody to talk to other than himself, and he's being pursued by this sort of being, sort of, you know, symbolic of death. And you've talked before about how when you're sort of promoting Doctor Who, like you say, like, you have to promote it as the figurehead of a brand. But something that appeals to you about it, it seems to me, that you've talked about it of the show, is the theme is the theme of death. That is a real motif in the show, because you have the Doctor as a character who dies, you know, mm-hmm. constantly, and then he regenerates, he renews himself, and comes back as a new person. And it's and you've talked before about how that's a really important theme for children who watch the show, and for people who watch the show, as something that is a primer for that idea, and it's something that enriches the whole story of that show. And I just wanted to ask, as someone who is, you know, hands up, a big fan of not only your run, but that episode, it's a really sort of special episode to me personally. What are your thoughts reflecting on that episode 10 years on?
I loved doing it. Hmm. It was a surprise. Other people seem to know before me. Before, I think Jenna said, you know, they're going to do an episode, but just you. I said, what? He said, yeah, I think that's what they've got planned. And then Stephen said, yeah, we're going to do one which is just the Doctor. I said, oh, I was sort of fascinated as to what that, I could, no idea what that could be. Because he didn't really explain it to me terribly. But then when it came along, I didn't seek to understand it. You know, we were very lucky in that we had Rachel Talalay, who directed it, is a wonderful, wonderful director. We didn't have very much time. There's not much time to direct. We did an episode in like 10 days or something. We knew that there were many levels in it, but we couldn't. We had to trust each other to look after our levels, the bits that were our responsibility. So my responsibility would be how to deliver these lines truthfully and effectively and with enough resonance that they might touch the sides of the mystery of the whole thing, of what it was really about. Because in the end, that's you might have to come to your own opinion about that. It's like a piece of music. It was reflective. It was philosophical. It was about being alive and being dead. But it's also a monster movie. Because I remember, because I walked onto the set, there's the castle, and then there's the graveyard where he's digging the grave. I said, this is like a Roger Corman movie. Roger Corman, you know who Roger Corman is, yeah?
Yeah.
Just in case some of your viewers might know. He did all these fabulous Edgar Allan Poe adaptations with Vincent Price, beginning with The Fall of the House of Usher.
Pit and the Pendulum.
Pit and the Pendulum, all of those things. And they were very vividly coloured but quite economically designed because they didn't have a lot of money. Because he was famous for making films very, very cheaply and making a lot of B-movies and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But also started the career of Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola. And ironically, Rachel had worked for him. I said, this is like a Roger Corman movie. And she said, yeah, that's what we're trying to do. It's to make this like, because it's the castle, the kind of Gothic castle, and then the green kind of slightly Hollywood-y kind of graveyard. And Steven said, yeah, that's right, because he'd put that. And I don't know what that's another thing of the way culture and imagination works, that American idea of a European horror story. Mind you, no, Edgar Allan Poe is American, isn't he? So I was thinking more of a Dracula-orientated thing there, in which is a European horror story filtered through American eyes.
Well, I think there's something interesting about how American eyes looking at European kind of iconography. Like one of my favorite, some of my favorite films are films made by British films or films made about Britain, but made by American directors. So Clockwork Orange by Kubrick, American, but very much about Britain in the 70s, or Phantom Thread, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, who, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis playing this very sort of upper crust, you know, Fitzrovian tailor, like Terry Gilliam's Brazil, being an outsider, and you can see something totally objectively in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I think if you're a filmmaker or just as an artist, you can then appraise it in a way that is almost heightened. And I feel like maybe that was what Rachel was doing with that episode. She was coming at it with those kind of external eyes.
Yeah, and she's very clever, and she's a real director, so she has a vision. So, and when I say that, I mean, there is a kind of, you know, a lot of directors just really come in and do a wide shot to cover everything and then do close-ups, you know, and that's fine. That's doing the job as well. But some people come in with a visual idea that is an expression of a deeper resonance in the scene. And that's what Rachel does, which is fabulous. And to me, that's what a director does, is they tell the story in their way. But it was an extra. I mean, the big trouble with Heaven Sent was in the middle of it. This is part of the branding. I had to go to San Diego to do So we stopped for a weekend, and I had to go and promote Doctor Who in America for 3 or 4 days, which was very cruel because America's full of pancakes and pastries and all delicious things that I'd like to eat, which I couldn't eat. Otherwise, I'd come back as a porkier version of myself. But it was really, I was sick of my own voice at the end of it. I was desperate to hear another actor. I was desperate to, because also you bounce off the other actors. You know, you never go in, you know, I like to prepare very thoroughly. But part of that preparation is knowing that everything will change. Because the other actors never say things the way you thought they would say them, which is brilliant. They totally surprise you. So that then changes what your preparation is, or how you want to deliver your lines. So there weren't any other actors. So that was hard. I was sick of hearing me. But it was very intense, because Rachel and I would hunker down between scenes and takes to try and figure out what was going on in the next scene and how to do it. And it was also great to be with the crew, who I knew the crew really well from, obviously I'd done like 2 years by that time, but they make it, they made the show and they made that episode, you know, and we all worked so closely with each other because we could, there were no other actors to distract us. We were all with the camera and sound and everything and design. We were all, I felt very much part of that whole team. So it's unusual in that respect.
Well, it's interesting to me, fascinating actually, what you say about how, because of course Doctor Who, the production schedule is so fast, like you say, you're shooting an episode on average in 10 days. And what the incredible thing about Heaven Sent in particular is that it does not feel like that at all. It feels like it was made with all the time in the world. Like there are, like some of the stuff that Rachel and you, like the interplay between her as a director and you as an actor, are doing, there are shots in that episode where you're walking down those kind of those long sort of Gothic corridors, and you're, you know, you're silhouetted by all this this golden light, and it's so precise and formal. It's a formal Doctor Who episode. It's like you say, it's philosophical in it, and it's almost, I mean, maybe this is quite a grandiose statement, but to my mind it's almost the closest the show has come to a kind of art house sort of episode, in the way it's very stripped down, and it's obviously, it's a one-hander and it's very gothic and heightened. And as I said before, for me personally, the episode has a lot of resonance because when it first came out, two of my grandparents died quite close to when it came out, you know, within weeks of each other, actually. And the episode is such a profound sort of story and meditation on grief that over time I did find myself coming back to it a lot.
Yeah.
And I found it really helped.
Yeah.
It did one of those great things that I think a film or a TV show or a book or a piece of art can do, is that it can help you through some of that.
Yeah.
That you know, those struggles. And yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's Stephen's episode, you know, and it's his story and his all of those things that you've touched upon are there in his writing. Mm. So really, you know, the greatest compliments should be paid to him, really, because it was a unique episode. And also in the sense that it sort of reached outside of Doctor Who, you know, and into a kind of deeper sort of level. And that's all him. It's all there, you know, in the script.
In the foundations. But then, of course, it is you and Rachel and Murray Gold as well, the composer, bringing that, and the crew, bringing that to life and making it hit home, like, emotionally.
It was great, great fun.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, something that I'd like to ask you about, Peter, is your sort of approach to acting, because you seem to me to be a great sort of practitioner of show, don't tell, as an actor, giving across all these subtleties and nuances of a character that you're playing, but without being too explicit and broad about it. And I see that with Malcolm Tucker. I see that in the sort of humanity that is sort of laced in there, all these little signs that, you know, these glances that he gives, to how he treats his assistant Sam in that show, in the thick of it. Mm-hmm. You know, he's very kind to her, but he's obviously, with a lot of the other characters, he's very, quite bullish. And in Doctor Who as well. I mean, something that's fascinating to me about your Doctor is the fact that almost from the beginning, it feels like Even in what he's wearing, you've kind of codified so much of the character. Because I want to say you picked out... Did you design the look of your Doctor, right? The sort of the David Lynch sort of buttoned up shirt and everything, boots.
It was a struggle. Because everybody... The worst thing about Doctor is everybody's got an opinion. Mm. So you've got to go through all of these hoops and you've got to please everybody. And also you're the new guy or the new girl, you know, you're the new person there, and the costume is so important to them, and some of the things they come up with are just, you know, you go, no,
nonsense.
I can't wear that, and I didn't, you know. And then you go to a warehouse and you dress up in all these kind of you just have to go through these motions of dressing up in these, and people do suggest scarves, you know, and velvet jackets, which I ended up in, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to be very, I wanted to reach back to the earlier days of the show that I remembered as a kid, which were in black and white, obviously. So I wanted a black and white costume, which they didn't like at all, because they like colour. I struggled. I actually went to Paul Smith, the designer.
Yeah, you're friendly with him, I want to say, right?
Well, I get a good discount at his shop. Well, he's brilliant.
Mm.
I said, I just really think it needs to be something quite cool looking, but quite dark.
Mm.
And he just had a workshop. We went into the workshop and and he had some, because he has designers that he works with, and they had some things lying around, and we put those things together, and they did it.
Mm.
They had a longish kind of, it's like Crombie-ish kind of jacket, and I think they had a spotty shirt, and that was. But they did it, and I remember because we took some photographs of it at the time. I thought, well, that's it. Really, that makes me feel like Doctor Who. That.
Yeah.
So then we had to try and translate that into the mechanics of the show. I liked that more formal, old-fashioned, a little bit trendy look. But it's hard to maintain because everybody comes along. Everybody who's new in the show wants to do a new thing with it. So here's a new jacket, or here's a new pair of trousers, or here's a new look.
Mm.
I'm the new designer. Here's a new thing. I go, well, I don't want a new thing.
The old thing. Yeah. Like I said, there's almost something, almost kind of David Lynchian or sort of David Byrne.
Oh, yeah, well, that's all David Lynch and David Bowie and all that stuff, just with a buttoned up shirt, because, which horrified people. Because they think, well, can't sell that, really.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so striking.
And well, I saw a little, funny, I was clearing up my little office the other day and I found this little figure. I think it was the first figure they made of me. And I've just got this white shirt buttoned up and this black trousers and black. And I thought, they must have been horrified. Going, how are we going to sell this? Can't we put multicolored dots all over this? Or
well, give them a tweed jacket at least. Yeah, yeah.
You know? I liked it. You know, and those earlier, the earlier incarnations of it are the best. But it's so difficult. In any kind of filmmaking, it's so difficult to keep an idea pure.
Because it kind of gets mediated through the...
It gets mediated because people turn up with other ideas. I mean, I think it was Kubrick said that, you know, I can't remember the quote exactly, but it more or less he's saying the only way you will be a director of any worth is if you resist with every fiber of your being anybody else's idea. And of course, it's a difficult thing because you also have to be open to other people's ideas. Because sometimes, and often, their ideas are better. So you've got to create an environment where a better idea, no matter where it comes from, can be deployed. But you also have to be strong enough to bat it off or invite it in. And you also got to look after people's feelings. You know, you can't go, oh, that's shit. Just go, oh, that's great. Yeah, I wonder, will that work? I'm not sure. Let me try it. We'll try it. Give it a go.
Yeah.
You know, as people do to me when, you know, if I've got an idea, I mean, it's interesting you're talking about acting. And acting to me is, I never went to drama school, so I was rejected from drama school. So I always felt lacking in the acting department. But I liked the idea of acting and I enjoyed doing it. But I've been so terrible in so many things. And that's where I've learned, is by being so terrible and just keeping on coming back. And I still don't really know how to do it. I'm not being facetious by saying that. I'm obviously have a process that I engage in. If I've got work to do, if I've got a job to do. But there's a kind of mystery in it that I don't... That is right. It's right. All art should have a mystery in it. You know, so if you very kindly said some nice things about me, and if those things have worked, I'm not really quite sure how I made that happen.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? But there's a zone you can reach where you are, things begin to move in your head and through your eyes that are slightly outside of your control. And sometimes the camera can see that and can interpret it in a way that is useful. But also a lot of it is editing. I mean, what you don't see are all the terrible takes and all the bits where I'm mugging and where I look like a kind of a pantomime performer or what, you know what I mean? And that's one of the great things about doing a job where you trust your collaborators. For instance, Doctor Who or the thick of it, you know, you're allowed to be terrible. You've got to have the courage to be terrible. And I have been terrible and will be again. But it's in that, it's in the leap to try and get to that other place, which might be a terrible place. In that journey, things emerge, some of which are good. But if you have a director who doesn't recognize that or who doesn't use it in the edit,
then it's a problem.
You know, because I've been in, I've done things where I thought I was okay and they've picked all the worst takes of me and I look terrible and they haven't used the bits where I was a bit better. But I love it, you know, and I still love trying to do it. And I love working with people. And when we did Criminal Record, which is the show we do for Apple, on the first season, there's a wonderful director called Sean James Grant, who's a brilliant young director. And we used to do takes where, you know, we're in episodic television. Our job is to tell this story and to get it done by the end of the day, deliver the show by February or whenever it is, has to be done. So you do takes where you tell the story. And then sometimes we'd say, okay, can we do one now where we don't know what's going to happen? Can I do one now with nothing going on? There's never nothing going on. Even when you're trying to do, even when I'm trying to do nothing, there's always something going on. So sometimes when you try and do nothing, you just try not to tell the story. The words tell the story. That's one of the key things that I learned, was the words tell the story. I don't like when actors come in and they say, oh, I'd like to change these words because that I don't think that's what the character would say, or this is not how the story would work. I think my character would say this or my character would say that. If you have to change the words to tell the story you think is the right one, you're not as good an actor as you should be, because you have all these other tools with which to tell the story. The words, that's just the surface of it. You know, at the same time, sometimes the words are terrible and you have to
you have to do a bit more work. I mean, with something like Criminal Record then, which you're obviously the star of but also a producer on, I mean, what you just said there about how sometimes the director will use takes that you weren't particularly like your favorite takes, so that you know, you felt there were other takes that you did better. Is that part of the reason why you've come on board that show as a producer? Because obviously as a producer you have more license to step into the editing room. You can say, okay, well, maybe not that shot, maybe that takes better. Was that one of the reasons why you wanted to sort of maybe to be a producer on that show?
It is one of the reasons, but I mean, the main reason is my wife is the executive producer. So she has produced, not that she has any particular interest in crime, but she was the first producer and pulled together and created Vera and Shetland and those shows. But, you know, she didn't make any money from those because she was just on the on the payroll. So she wanted to put together a show that was about a specific thing. And she asked me if I would be interested in doing this part. Because it was an idea that she had about why people will admit to things and, you know, in it that they're not guilty of. They'll say they're guilty of something. And she looked into that a lot. So she developed this story. And then she said, well, there's this character I think you'd be... And I said, oh, well, that sounds great. Yeah, let's do that. She hadn't sold the show yet, and as she started to try that, I became involved in selling the show, and I also began to see it more vividly. I began to see what I thought it should look like. So I became more and more involved in how it might be as a show. So it became natural that I would be take on a role to push it along those areas, which is a kind of executive producer role. But as it ends up, I do get to look at my takes. I don't take a huge, and I think it's not really my job to look after, to stick my nose into other actors' business. So I try to step away from that. But I will look at my takes and think, oh, that's not good, or that is good. And so I do have more of a say in that, while at the same time trying to maintain a distance.
Because you are a filmmaker. I mean, it must be said, I mean, for anyone who's not aware, I mean, like, you're an Oscar-winning filmmaker. Your short film from the 90s, Franz Kafka's It's a Wonderful Life with Richard E. Grant, which is brilliant, won BAFTA and an Oscar. You know, I rewatched it again over the weekend. It's lovely. It holds up. You directed Strictly Sinatra as well, your film from 2001, I want to say, early noughties. And then you worked with Joe Brand on Getting On. And you're someone who clearly has such a strong finger on the pulse of your interests in terms of filmmaking, like, you know, because like Franz Kafka's It's a Wonderful Life is so stylish and it looks incredible and it's framed so beautifully and it's so funny and it's original. Do you ever feel desire to pick up a camera again and direct?
I do sometimes. I mean, the reason I stopped it was, well, I mean, the reason I started it was that I'm just interested in all these things. It wasn't a case of saying, oh, I want to be a director. Although there was a point where I thought it would be easy, I thought that it was possible to go off and become an auteur or something like that. But it's not possible unless you're prepared to put a huge amount of work and effort and labour into that. And also to survive the challenges and the knockback and the knocks it gives you. I don't think I'm somebody who is, these are not all separate things to me. So if I'm acting in something, I'm using the same resources that I use if I was directing something or if I was making music. It's the same thing. It's other people who are deciding that you're a director or you're an actor or, you know, or you're a music, that these are separate. To me, they're not separate things. They're just stuff that I like to do. I don't profess to be great at any of them or very special at any of them. I know that I've survived long enough to have been to develop a skill in some of these areas that has allowed me to survive. But they are just, I always say, when I was a little kid, I made a little studio out of a shoebox. And in that studio, and this was, I had the Beatles. I had little cut-out Beatles that I made and little cut-out cameras. Because in those days, there was a show called Top of the Pops that was, you may or may not remember.
Sure.
But before that, there was a show called Ready, Steady, Go. Mm-hmm. The convention then, which I guess they got from American TV, was that you saw the cameras. Mm. If the Beatles or the Rolling Stones were on and the kids were dancing, you'd also see the cameras moving among them. So you could see the studio. So I somehow saw that there was a place where this stuff all happened. So I made this little place out of a shoebox. Mm. I made a little stage and made my little lab. So I just feel all of this stuff is connected. Mm. It's all from the same well. Mm, it's not unusual that you will find, you know, art school is full of people who become musicians, you know, or that, you know, actors become directors or writers. Because this is what, you know, if you went back to Shakespearean times, the actors would do their own makeup. Mm-hmm. You know, they probably, someone would be good at painting sets.
It was a troupe. It was a proper troupe mentality, I guess.
Yeah. And communal. People's skills would be deployed to put on the show. But as we have moved into our age of television and professionalism, these crafts have been sanctioned. Well, for me, I always think actors should do their own makeup. Mm. I don't know why you sit in a makeup chair and you let somebody who you don't know go, I think the character's hair's like this. Mm. But really? What do you know about this? Mm. I remember once being in a show. I was in this TV thing and it was set in the 70s. There were some flashbacks to the 70s and I had to appear in these flashbacks for the 70s. And the lady who was doing my makeup gave me these huge sideburns. And she said, she stuck them on and she said, this is... I said, why am I wearing this? And she said, because that's what people wore in the 70s. I said, all right, okay. And then I thought, wait a minute, I was alive in the 70s. I was there in the 70s. Mm. And I didn't have these. Mm. So can we not take these off?
And what did she say? Was she like, no, you've got to keep them on?
She said, I'd rather you kept them on because that's what people wore in the 70s. I don't remember.
Did she have you in flares as well?
Flares was fine. I had flares. But do you know what I mean? You had to, there was actors had more, their sort of remit was larger. Mm. It wasn't just delivering the lines and being charismatic. Mm. They might have to paint the clouds and the set and do their makeup and everything. I think that's fun.
Mm. Well, touching on one of your most famous acting roles, Malcolm Tucker, which we mentioned earlier, The Thick of It. I mean, speaking of anniversaries, as we say, this year is the anniversary of Heaven Sent. This year is also the 20th anniversary of The Thick of It, which I guess is kind of scary for a lot of us. Yeah. And with The Thick of It, because that is sort of provided the blueprint or an instruction manual for, I guess, a lot of politicians in a weird roundabout way. It seems to me to be, I mean that in a slightly facetious way, but the world that delves into and shines a light on, you know, shining a light on the corridors of power and how, and the spin and the lies and the fallibility of all those people who work in that sector. There's a line in Spinners and Losers, The Thick of It special, where I think Glenn, the character Glenn, is talking to a cleaner and she says, and all this stuff is going on, you know, behind the scenes, this kind of very funny but very sinister stuff. And she says, people need to know about this. People should know about this. And to me, that kind of almost sums up what the show was doing. It was like it was shining a light on all that stuff at a time when maybe we thought politics was quite dusty, maybe. I don't know if we feel that way now or with everything that's been going on. But I guess for you, reflecting on it now, it's been 20 years. Do you feel like that was the mission of the show? And if so, do you think it succeeded in what it was trying to do?
I don't know what the mission of the show was. I think Amanda would say, well, I don't know what Amanda was about. I know that he was just very inspired by Yes Minister and wanted to do a kind of modern version of that. I think he wanted to, or was keen to show the world how it was working, which is not how we thought it was working, which is that there were all these incredibly young advisors who really didn't know anything about the world, who were advising these ministers who were under increasing pressure from the Malcolms or whatever to feed the brand. Yeah. you know, again, to furnish unacceptable sound bites and all of this kind of stuff, and to follow a party line. But I think we know that now.
Mm.
I don't think it did us any good, really.
No,
because we're just in a terrible place. So
yeah, well, it's all of that world of, I guess, spin. Again, your character Michael Tucker being kind of the king of spin in a lot of ways in the show. You know, it's so barefaced, it seems to me now. It's out in the open. There's no hiding it, and people, it just happens now. Like, and there almost isn't any need to spin how sort of venal it can be in some of those people can be, obviously, in those positions of power. I mean, for you playing that character, inhabiting that character, Malcolm Tucker, I remember one time you said with Malcolm that playing him was quite tough because he seems on the surface to exist at such a sort of level of anger and sort of bullishness. But as I said before, you kind of laced in there. You've got all this, you have got a humanity underneath there, like the way he treats Sam, his assistant, when she's kind of getting bullied in one scene when he's being forced out.
Yeah.
And he comes in and says, leave her alone.
Yeah.
You know? And in the inquiry where you're at the end of the show, I mean, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen it, but you know, you're in the dock in the inquiry and then Sam's behind you.
Yeah.
And she's devastated that this is happening to you because you're kind of being hung out to dry. I guess, was it a challenge playing Malcolm with all that going on, I guess, the being that existing on that level of sort of high intensity, it seems to me, but also subtlety?
Yeah, I mean, it was a constant challenge because we didn't... I mean, it was a great, great experience.
Mm.
It was a great learning experience about acting. It was probably the most formative. The actor that I am now probably comes from there. The important thing was just to be alive in front of the camera.
Mm.
Not to, I learned that. Previously, I thought myself was beginning to understand technique and beginning to understand lenses and beginning to understand, you know, if they put an 85mm lens on, that would be a close-up, and if it was a 28mm lens, it would be a wide-angle lens, and that would be possibly full figure. And I thought, oh, well, I'll modulate my acting to suit these different lenses and trying to understand the technology of filmmaking. So that I could dance with it or be a part of it.
Mm.
But it was the wrong, what the thick of it taught me, was that none of that mattered. Because they shot it on two cameras, always with two cameras, and they were on zoom lenses.
Mm.
So a zoom lens meant they could have been on the other side of the room. And the shot might be like that.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't know. So there was no point in trying to modulate a performance.
Mm.
The only point was trying to be truthful. While at the same time, you had all of these lines, which were not naturalistic. They were sort of Baroque kind of, obviously the swearing and all that, blah, blah, blah. But the construction of the gags and jokes was quite complex.
Mm.
So there was a trick that you had to do, which was you had to make that appear naturalistic.
Mm.
But it's not natural.
No, I mean, Alistair Campbell doesn't presumably actually, you know, come out with all that brilliant. I mean, it's the kind of dialogue that you can chew up and spit out as an actor. It's like, because I hear what you're saying, you're being naturalistic, but also it felt to me like you must have had so much fun just, you know, getting these lines and just throwing them out.
Well, it was worrying because it was because they did rewrite a lot, and Malcolm did have big chunks of stuff to do, so I was worried about delivering it all. And the other thing is that if you look at the plots of the thick of it, the departments that he's dealing with are really low down.
Mm.
That's the boiler room. You know, really what people forget about Malcolm is he's not spending all of his time dealing with... Malcolm's at the Foreign Office or he's dealing with, you know, transport, or he's dealing with big health. He's dealing with big issues and big guns. And then something goes wrong downstairs at, you know, the Department of Social Affairs, where nobody gives a fuck about anybody there. And he's got to come all the way fucking downstairs to deal with these people who are never going to get anywhere. But they're still going to make an appearance on the telly. So they've got to say the right fucking thing. So just say the right thing so that I can go back up to the fucking Foreign Office and deal with whatever's going on, you know, in Afghanistan or whatever. Yeah. But I don't want to have to come down here again.
Mm. You want to go back up to your proper job.
Yeah. But he always has to come down and deal with these losers.
Oh, God.
And, but yes, I thought Armando's so clever, though. He did a wonderful thing, I think, in it, which was a great helped me this. I can't remember. Malcolm has a friend. Malcolm gets the sack or something like that. And he's at home and he's got his friend with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And you never really expect, who's his friend? Mm. You know, is this guy who's slightly kind of wasted looking. And
he's got sideburns, I think, as well. He's got
that's
big
right,
sideburns.
Yes.
Yeah.
But of course, who his friend is really... Well, what he's saying is Malcolm's an alcoholic. Mm. So he has a friend from AA who, when things are very stressful, he has to call and say, look, I really want a drink. What can I do? So he had this friend. So this friend around or in the background, that was a real kind of help because I thought, yeah, he's really struggling to do this thing. And Malcolm doesn't, you know, Malcolm's just doing his job, you know. He's trying to, his job is to sell the government's line. He doesn't come up with the government's line. It's just his job is to sell it.
Yeah. Say what I like about him. He seems to be 100% committed to his party. There's no, you know.
Well, he is. Yeah, but at the end, he says that it's in the big scene at the when they're having the inquest into all. He does say that it's taken a wrong turn by presentation being the most important thing.
Popularity.
Rather than content, yeah. So he recognises that. But he's not paid to do that. He's paid to make sure the presentation works.
Mm. I mean, I'm sure that you've been asked this question many times over the years, but do you have a favourite, like, Tuckerism, if you will, like a favourite line that you were given that you just, that delivering that line, that was a good day, I guess, that you got that. Do you have, like, a favourite one of those?
No, there's so many brilliant. I mean, funnily enough, we did a little, because it was the 20th anniversary, we did a little evening, and we got together Rebecca and Chris Addison and Armando and I on stage. And people always ask what, and I don't have a favourite line, but there's a great, you know, what happened was they began to write more and more effective scenes that had more and more layers in them. And there's a scene when Ollie, who is his, you know, Ollie reveals himself to be a complete, you know, if I can say that word.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And he's going to stab Malcolm in the back because he's after Malcolm's job. Mm. And Malcolm's got nothing left. He's used up all of his resources. And he says, I've got nothing to pull out of my magic hat. He says, I'm pulling the rabbits out, but their heads are dropping off and frightening the children. And he goes on like that. And then he accuses Chris. He says, you're no Malcolm Tucker. He said, you're not even Manchester's top Malcolm Tucker tribute band.
I mean, how can you come back from that?
This whole speech goes on like this about how hopeless he is. Mm. And how, but that idea of purple rabbits out of their head and their hat, their heads dropping off, frightening the children.
It's the Dark Magician thing, like, you know, like the that Dark Magician vibe.
Well, it's also just that it's all over, you know, it's such a mess. But it's so vivid, the image is so vivid. And I like those. I mean, of course, there's lots of lines which are great, but I like the fact that they began to do scenes where there were journeys, you know, and Malcolm had these journeys that he embarked upon. But Chris was great. I mean, he was just incredible. He's so naturalistic. I mean, his acting is, you just look at that acting, you go, how can you be so, I mean, that was the great thing about that show as well. You look at all this acting going on, you go, my God, they're all so realistic. And they've got this pantomime dame in the back shouting and swearing and, you know. Oh, that's amazing acting.
Yeah, but that's the I think one of the many keys to that show's brilliance, the fact that it doesn't, that whole thing of like capturing the truth about something, about a set, like it's almost like all of those performances, like yourself and Chris and Rebecca Front and all those guys, it's so natural, it's like breathing. Like you watch that, you can't smell the acting when you watch that show. It's so
smell the acting.
Yeah, you can't smell the acting.
We don't like to smell the acting
in any kind of way. I mean, some of my favorite scenes from that show, and talking about interplay between actors, is all the stuff of you and David Haig, Steve Fleming, you know, the Gallagher brothers of politics. I mean, that's my favorite stuff. And you watch some of those scenes and you think, how the hell did you make, were you able to make it through some of these scenes without just corpsing? Because the stuff that you're, that he's coming out with and you're bouncing back on is just, is hysterical.
Well, I generally was able to make it. I wasn't a great corpser because generally I was too worried. And also what happened as well, as the show went on and was successful, actors who joined the show decided that they would have to best Malcolm. So I became a target there. For everybody who came on the show decided they would have a gladiatorial bout with me, which was very exhausting. But I still beat them.
I was going to say, and he was, and David Akerman and Steve Fleming, the chief gladiator. Anyways, I mean, Malcolm literally writes his resignation letter.
Yeah.
So he's coming in with a lot of hellfire, I guess.
Talking about smelling the acting, do you know where the expression ham comes from? You know what a ham actor is, right? What's a ham actor?
Someone who overacts.
Overacts, right, okay. In the 18th century, when people appeared on stage, there was no electricity, so the lights would be candle-lit, etc., and they would generate a certain amount of heat. So the stage became quite a hot place. And obviously the actors would wear makeup. Those actors who were not so well off used a makeup that that was held together with pig fat. So the pigment would be held together with pig fat. So they would apply this. And so they were basically applying pig fat with rouge to their faces. So when they got in front of the lights, which were very hot, the pig fat would be heated up and the smell of ham.
Oh, God. It's like permeating.
Would begin to fill the air. That's where I became an actor of a cheat of more humble means, which doesn't necessarily mean they're a bad actor, but that's why they became called hams.
Very shiny as well, I'm guessing.
They smell of pigs. They smelt of ham.
Dragging the good name of actors in that time down even further, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Wow. So on the subject of Malcolm, as we say, we're talking about the thick of it. Something that I mentioned before we rolled was, and like I say, this is, I guess, my sort of, I'm feeling the weight of my anorak here, my sort of nerd anorak. As we said before, like, so you're familiar with Alan Moore. You've heard the name of Alan Moore, the comic writer. So he wrote a comic book called The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I'll explain where I'm going with this, but basically he created this comic book where in the pages of this story, he created this sort of quite wonderful world where and scenario where every fictional character that has ever existed, going back to Shakespeare's time and before, exists in this sort of shared world. So you have P.J. Woodhouse rubbing shoulders with like H.P. Lovecraft, if you can imagine that. And he writes stories along those lines. And there's a volume of that set in the present day. And Malcolm turns up in it. The world of the thick of it exists in this melting pot.
Yeah.
And Alan's a friend of Armando's, and he asked Armando if he could include Malcolm in the comic. And Armando said yes. So we actually have the comic with us. This is all quite contrived. I'm sorry.
Very naturalistic.
Very naturalistic. Where basically, you know, this is it here. Like I say, filling the anorak.
Yeah.
This is the piece. And there's a situation where Malcolm's being interviewed on Channel 4 News by Jon Snow back when he was news anchor. And it's a very sort of sweary confrontation that he has, typical Malcolm with Jon Snow. And we've taken the liberty of writing and printing it out, which even that alone was quite fun.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you'd potentially be up for a little, I guess, role play, if you want to call it that, me being Jon Snow and yourself being Mr. Malcolm Tucker.
Yeah.
I mean, I've actually not done this before. I've never been a scene partner before. How does this work? What should I be doing? Like, you know, is there any sort of tips you can give me for...
You speak and you listen.
Okay.
That's all acting is.
I think I can do that.
Speaking and listening.
Thing is, have you guys got any like ham I can put? Like, not ham, the pig fat maybe I need, might need, might be like...
Do you know who I heard say speaking and listening? Robert Duvall, one of the greatest actors ever. So...
He said, okay, Channel Duvall. Okay, cool.
Channel Duvall.
So Duvall in the role of Jon Snow, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're on Channel 4. This is Channel 4 News. I'm sitting across from Malcolm Tucker. I'm Jon Snow. You can believe it.
Now, you've come from as Jon Snow from the Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Does that make me a White Walker? I'd like to be a White Walker. Aren't they the best monsters ever? I always thought Doctor Who would be great fighting a White Walker.
A no-brainer, wouldn't it? Yeah. I feel like they could come from the same, you know, arena as the Ice Warriors.
Well, it was quite very. We used to have Maisie Williams from Game of Thrones, who was in that season of Doctor Who.
Of course, yeah.
Who was great, but she was filming Game of Thrones at the same time. And I love Game of Thrones. And I'd say, shut up, mate. I don't want to know what happens.
And would she tell you anyway? Would she hold that over you like a sword of Damocles?
She would, but she would accidentally let spill some things. I have to stop her. She was great. I loved her. Maisie around. Okay.
Okay, so so Robert Duvall. Okay.
Duvall,
sorry.
Do you know who that is?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Godfather Part Godfather 2.
Conversation.
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now.
Don't think he's in the conversation. That's
not in Godfather 3 either, sadly.
He's not in Godfather 3, no. His role was taken by that actor with the facelifts. What's his name?
Oh, I'll let him box it.
All right, sorry. All right. Wasting your time.
So, Mr. Tucker.
George Hamilton.
George Hamilton. Yeah. All right, Mr. Tucker, thanks for coming.
It's an indescribable pleasure, John.
So, Mr. Tucker, are we returning to an era of spin?
Well, that depends, John. Are you deliberately stamping on my cock?
I'm not sure.
Because if you are, I'll take that fucking repulsive unicorn vomit tie, ram it down your throat, and when it emerges from the other end in a kind of river... Let's start again. Ram it down your throat when it emerges from the other end. In a kind of reverse. Okay, all right. How do you say elementary?
Elementary, I think that's how you say it. Elementary.
Who wrote that?
Fucking Alan. Take it up with
me. Elementary. All right, let's start again.
Okay. From the top.
Do you want to give me any setup here? Any advice? Am I annoyed?
I guess at the start you're quite sort of bold and brash. You're back in number 10.
All right, let's go.
And then you sort of.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Tucker, thanks for coming.
It's an indescribable pleasure, John.
So, Mr. Tucker, are we returning to an era of spin?
Oh, well, that depends, John. Are you deliberately stamping on my cock?
I'm not sure I...
Because if you are, I'll take that fucking repulsive unicorn vomit tie, ram it down your throat, and when it emerges from the other end in a kind of reverse fisting, I'll use it to floss your alimentary canal. Do I make myself perfectly fucking clear?
Mr. Tucker, thank you for coming in.
There you are. Now children fucking need.
Oh, that was amazing.
They never put any Think of It characters on children need.
No, they should. I mean, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? You get that? Yeah, people be coughing up all the pennies and pounds for that. Oh, that was wonderful. Thank you so much. But now for something completely different, I guess. We mentioned way back at the start when we were talking about Franz Ferdinand and, Glastonbury and your music career. Yeah. Early this year, you had Sweet Emotions. Sweet Illusions. Out in the spring, second solo album, St. Christopher, was your first.
Yeah.
It's terrific.
Thank you.
As someone who is, as you say, all these things, acting, music, filmmaking, they're all kind of the same, one and the same for you. Like, what was the germination of that album and, how did it come about?
That's because I have a friend called Dr. Robert Howard, who was in a band called The Blow Monkeys. He's in a band called The Blow Monkeys, who were a big band in the 80s. Mm. And he's a friend of mine. Mm. And he's a guy at a party who can lift up a guitar and he can play in it. He's a walking jukebox. Mm. And although I always liked to play the guitar, I was never a guy at a party who did that. I didn't like doing that. I couldn't do that. Mm. But I hung around with him a lot. And then he would say, play with me. So if he played, I would start to play with him. And then he used to have a small label and they used to release an album a year. And the album was were odd kind of conglomerations of different musicians, friends of his that he had around, Mick Talbot and people like that. Mm. I happened to be around when they were recording one of these albums. And he said, write a song. I said, what? He said, write a song. He said, you used to write songs when you were a kid. Right? He said, write a song and come in and we'll do it. Hmm. I thought, oh, okay. Hmm. So I went home and I wrote a song and I brought it in and they played it. And it was like amazing. So I've never played with anyone who can play really. When I was in a band, we were all at the same kind of level, all kind of trying to find our, learn how to play instruments. These people could play and they played the song and they did it. They made it music. I thought, this is so great. I've got to do this. I've got to do more of this just because it's fun. Mm. And then I went off to America to do the the Suicide Squad. And I was there for months, even though I could have filmed my part in about 3 weeks. But I was there for, and I thought, well, I'll write a song every day, because I heard a statistic that you have to write 100 terrible songs and able to, in order to get one decent one. I don't know if I've managed that yet at all. But I thought, well, just do it. So I just write all these terrible, terrible songs. Hmm. And because technology has changed, because technology, now you have GarageBand, Logic and all this stuff, you can, all you need is your laptop and you can start to make music. So I would do these little demos and I would send them to Robert, and then he would send them to somebody he knew who was a great guitarist or somebody who was a great drummer, and they'd come back with these great musicians having done their stuff on it. So he said we should do an album. So we did. We did St. Christopher, which was fun. And I thought, well, I want to do this again. So I just, so it's just really a hobby. It's just really something I like to do. So, and again, I did a lot of demos and Robert worked on them. And then I went, he lives in Spain. So we went over to Spain and finished off recording it there. I think there was an advancement between the first album and this one. And hopefully there'll be an advancement between this one and the next one. It's just really something I enjoy doing. It's not like I'm not trying to be a pop star or anything. It's just, this is so, I can just lose myself in this and there's no pressure. It's not like, it doesn't have to be successful. It's not supporting anything and nobody else is employed in it. It's just me. It's just, and there's nobody else to say it should be like this or it should be like that, other than Robert or some other trusted people who have, you know, as opinions about the artistic direction, and I've just enjoyed it so much. And then we died this year. I thought, let's see if we can do this. Let's see if I can play in front of an audience. So my friend Christine Dinwoody, who works, you know, with Bernard Butler and Altered Images and people like that, she said, "Well, I'll help you put a band together," and she put together a band of like-minded young people, and they were amazing. I was very nervous playing with them, but they played all these songs. So we've done about 4 gigs, which is really exciting, and we're going to do a tour in next year.
Oh,
so
fantastic! Because that was going to be my next question. Were there any plans to tour it?
Yeah, at the end of February, we'll do just for a couple of weeks. We'll do small venues and just take it out there. But it's been so enjoyable, and it's really, but as I said to the band, you know, if it's not fun, we're not doing it. It's not an industry. We're not building an empire. We're not trying to take this to a higher level. It's just for the joy of making music. And you know, I used to do this when I was 17 and 18. I'd go and do gigs, and you know, spent all my years at art school and thereafter doing gigs. And but then somewhere along there, I lost all my nerve and got frightened and nervous about it. So this has been delightful, you know. But there is no plan for world domination.
Just not following in the footsteps of Davros with this one. You're going to just keep it.
No, I thought you were going to say Lewis Capaldi.
Oh, Lewis. Probably more of an apt comparison.
He's amazing. He's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, like, you say that and I hear that, but like I say, the music between you and Lewis, there is, you know, a real sort of musical bone in the, I guess, in the Capaldi clan, I guess. I mean, what's that like, sort of both of you doing your music, obviously very separate, but having that kind of, I guess...
He's huge. I mean, I don't, you know, I don't have anything to... I mean, Lewis, I didn't know, but early on in his career, I saw him and I thought he was great. I got in touch with him because I'd seen him on... You know, I thought he was fantastic. And I went to see him at a gig and was, you know, just a little one, and I was amazed. I thought I was so proud of him, even though I didn't know him, really. I mean, he is part of my family. And then he asked me, I was in the original video for Someone You Love, which was great. So he's amazing. Well, I think he's incredible.
Yeah.
But no, that's, you know, I'm not trying to be anything like that. I couldn't be, you know, he's devoted his life. You know, I'm very conscious of the fact that my friends who are musicians, whether they're world famous or just surviving, have dedicated their lives to this. You know, it's a calling. And they have gone through the ups and downs. I haven't done that. You know, I have done that with acting and with the other things that I'm involved with. So I'm deeply respectful of their experience and position and commitment, and don't pretend to be in any way the same as them. What I would say is that I don't think that music itself has any qualms about attaching itself to anybody who has a go.
Mm. Well, it's that punk ethos of like, you know, here's a chord, here's another chord, here's a third chord, now form a band. It's like just pick up a guitar or a drum kit and do it.
Yeah, but I think that's the same with all art. I think everyone should be encouraged to have a go.
Mm.
To, you know, because you might be great at it and you don't know. You might also not be great at it now, but if you have a go at it, and maybe in a year's time, if you keep having a go, you'll suddenly break through and discover that you do have a skill or a talent in that area. But no, it's great fun. I love it. And I love playing with the band. They're just amazing. I can't believe they just sound amazing, you know.
Yeah, no, they do. And the record is terrific. And everything you just said there about just the enjoyment factor of doing it.
Yeah.
You can really hear that on the record. Like so many songs like The Big Guy I loved and Bin Night as well was a great song. You know, Is It Today? Thank and something that I wanted to touch on, because I'm a big Lou Reed fan.
All right, yeah.
And I know you're a big Lou Reed fan. Yeah. Berlin, one of your favourite albums, I want to say.
Yeah.
There's a real, to me, listening to it with that sort of in my ear, there's a kind of, I thought I sort of felt a kind of, there's the guitar sound on it is so great, and it's quite stripped down but muscular. It reminded me a lot of Lou's playing in sort of that late 80s New York kind of period. Was that something that you were thinking about when you were
Well, because of my age, you know, you're going to the big influences are obviously Bowie and Lou Reed and Talking Heads and all of those people, you know. That was within my art school playlist, was all that, as well as Sex Pistols and Clash and all that, but they did not wipe out, you know, Lou Reed and Bowie and those people. They somehow were part of that whole thing as well. And no, Lou Reed was amazing. I used to, you know, pull a lot of all-nighters trying to do the work that I had to do at art school. I would, you know, always have Berlin on or... But I mean, Transformer is like just one of the greatest albums
it's my favorite
ever
album.
Made. I mean, it's fantastic. You listen to that, every single song on it is amazing. And also the production on it is... so clever and so inventive, and his voice, of course, is extraordinary. And also the simplicity in it, the simplicity of, but the depth of the lyrics is amazing. And also he had a lot of, he was always releasing live albums. So you could hear his versions with him playing guitar. And he always had a very strong band with him.
Like Rock and Roll Animal, that whole
thing. Rock and Roll Animal,
which is great. It's got, I think, a couple of guys who ended up in, it's not Metallica, but like, he's got a couple of really heavy guitarists on that and backing him up, and all those songs just get.
Well, Sweet Jane, as soon as he starts Sweet Jane, those chords, and then also that lead line over it all is like, you go, wow, that's just, it's a live sound, but it's very powerful and it's great.
Yeah, and I thought I did feel some of that on.
Well, inevitably, I mean, because I'm just sort of, all I'm doing is really going back to where I started. I'm just picking up where I left off. So all of my influences are it's really, I guess, it's an art student's kind of album, you know, from 1981 or something, or 1980, really. Probably I didn't have the skill then to do it, but now I've surrounded myself with people who do. So I'm able to lean into that a bit more. But it's very, I find it very satisfying, because as a creative thing, it's ultimately can do it on my own.
You can write those songs on your own and just put it together like blueprint.
And the technology is available, so you can put it on your laptop and make stuff. And it doesn't have to sell. It doesn't have to be successful. It doesn't have to make a mark in the world. It's just created and it's there. Because when I was young, you had to be signed to a record label, because they were the only ones who could afford studios and all that stuff. It's completely different now.
Yeah, I mean, you say that. I mean, the album was, I think it won to reach top five of like of the alternative album charts.
It was all very confusing because I didn't really know anything about any of that stuff. But that's fine. That's good. You know, it's not, you know, it's there and people can listen to it. And what is lovely about the world now is that anybody can release an album and it's there. If you want to go and look at it and listen to it, you can do it. And you don't need this great corporation behind you. I mean, that said, I think if you want to be successful in that business, you have to have that kind of corporate muscle still behind you. So I remember when we did my first album, it was fun getting it. We wanted to obviously have vinyl, put it on vinyl. But they said to us, no, every vinyl factory has been booked by Adele. because her new album's coming out. So you couldn't get, nobody could make any of their own records until Adele's album would come out. I love Adele, God bless Adele. But she used up all the vinyl for the first half of the year, that year.
It reminds me of when Kubrick was making The Shining on, in I think, Pinewood or Elstree, and it was just, he had all the stages for the Overlook. And then everyone like Spielberg and all these other filmmakers were trying to get in there to, you know, to set up Raiders of the Lost Ark and all these things. And Kubrick was like, I'll be done. You know, I'm done soon. No, when I'm finished, basically. So one last question I wanted to ask you before we finish. So you've worked with, over your career, with so many amazing filmmakers and writers and storytellers, people like Bill Forsyth on Local Hero and Ken Russell. We haven't even talked, you know, Ken Russell on Lair of the White Worm and Armando, obviously, on Thick of It, and Stephen Moffat and Russell T. Davis and Paul King as well on the Paddington movies. I mean, so many great people. I mean, in an ideal world, if you could sort of pick and choose someone who you're really excited about, you know, who's out there now doing great work, I mean, who would you sort of want to work with the most if you could sort of work with anybody like today?
You mean someone who's well known?
I guess so, or someone, just someone that you're excited about. The idea of working with them and collaborating with them sort of gets you excited.
I don't know. I think it's unfair to try to pick on somebody. I mean, some people I have long-standing relationships with, which are deeper. You know, I mean, Armando and Stephen I've worked with a lot, and so we have a relationship. So we're further down the road. So I'd be delighted to work with either of them because we are, we understand each other. But at the same time, you know, I get to work on the Apple show with new directors, and it's always exciting. You know, people, especially younger people with new ideas and who are exploring techniques and learning new ways of doing things. I don't know. Who would you like to work with? Who do you think? Who should I work with?
Who should you work with? Oh, God. I mean...
Who do you think's really good, though?
Who I think's really good? I mean, we've got back here Punch Drunk Love. I mean, this Paul Thomas Anderson, who made this film, is one of my favourites.
Yeah.
He did One Battle After Another quite recently, the Leo DiCaprio film.
Yeah, but he's not asking me to do any work. So that's not happening, so...
I'm sure... I mean, he's a big UK comedy fan. He's a big, you know, like, he loves Brass Eye, and I'm sure he's a fan of Thick of It and all that great stuff, so I'm sure he's...
maybe you can put a word in for him.
If I ever get him on the pod, I'll definitely be putting in a word. Right. But even just like working with like James Gunn on Suicide Squad, I mean, that is also...
Oh, James is great.
James, yeah.
James is lovely.
He seems like he's got great energy.
James is such a nice person, such a good person, but also incredibly prepared. I can, you know, I just love watching, you know, I wasn't in that movie very much, but I loved hanging around because the scale of it, the scale of these American movies is so much bigger than what we're used to. Even Doctor Who, which is very humble, really. Doctor Who is very humble. I remember that we made this scene in a building, on a high-rise building, office block. At the top of it, there's a penthouse with an aquarium. Two or three floors down, there are offices in which the Suicide Squad find themselves, I don't know, trying to defuse a bomb or something like that. But then a grenade goes off, and the building begins to keel over like this. And as it keels over, the aquarium, which is enormous, cracks open and all the water begins to flow down the building and into the floor that the Suicide Squad and sweeps them out. They built a floor of the building in the studio that could be flooded at will. It was like on a gigantic gimbal. So they'd say action. And they'd flood it with water from above. And then as they flooded it, it would begin to lean over like this. And the actors would begin to flow out of it. And then they'd say cut and they'd put it back. And the water would all be pumped out and then they'd do it again.
Wow.
But that was like three times the size of this space.
This humble space.
They built a thing. They built the floor of a building that can...
Like that. Just do whatever they want with it.
Yeah.
That must be when you're just like being surrounded by all that machinery and all that circus like, I guess.
Yes, you know what was amazing though? I always remember, this is what I thought was amazing, was we did a scene that was, there was a rain machine. Now, if you're in the UK, a rain machine can go from a fairly professional looking thing, rig. They always look as that little bit as that they're handmade. But there's a fairly professional rig, which is like plumbing pipes, which is up there. Somebody turns a lever and water comes down. or you will have someone with a hose or all this kind of stuff. They had a rig on a crane that was so high above us that when they turned it on, you could see the rain coming. And it would be a couple of seconds before it actually hit you. And then when they could alter the look of it. I think they had some kind of, they could make it whiter or, you know. But we still had to stand in the rain all day long. And Margot Robbie was there, and she was in some terrible Harlequin kind of fairium, scanty kind of thing.
It's like a dress or some kind, I'd say, in that scene, yeah.
And she was so amazing. She stood in the rain all day long for like 3 days and never complained. And smiled and was warm and was friendly to everyone. And I thought, that's great. That's the real thing right there. Because I have been in circumstances where people have moaned from the word go about the slightest discomfort. I thought, wow, that's amazing.
Well, I thought you were going to say when you said that rain machines in Britain can go from a rain machine to obviously being non-existent because it just rains all the time. You don't even need one.
It's a bit risky.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on Half the Picture, Pete. This was such a pleasure. And thank you for indulging us in our, not only our questions, but also the, I guess, the Tuckerisms and everything else. So, no, this
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for being interested. Appreciate it very much.
Our pleasure, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.